Henry stood by the bed, facing his mother. On the bus ride home, he had heard the latest reports on the fighting on Guadalcanal. But to his parents, the war with Japan was always seen from the Chinese side. They fought a different war. Still, Henry was 13 now, a man's age in his father's eyes, those same eyes that no longer regarded Henry as his son. Yet here he was, being given the one thing his father had always wanted most for Henry, a chance for him to return to China, a place he'd never known, never been, to live with relatives he'd never met. To his father, this was the most precious thing he could give Henry, and as much as Henry had feared this day would come, part of him wanted to go, at least to be able to come back with an understanding of what made his father who he was. But Henry knew better. "He's just doing this to keep me from her," he said. He studied his mother's face, searching for a confirmation in her expression, in her reaction. "This is his dream. He's worked and saved for years to give this to you, to do this for you, so you can know where you came from. Haven't you dishonored him enough?" The words stung, but Henry had been stung before. "Why now?" "The army, the Japanese, it's finally safe. Why now? Why today? It's not any safer getting there. The Japanese submarines have been sinking half the ships in and out of southern China. Why do I know all this? Because that's all he's talked about for my entire life. This is his house. You are his son," his mother snapped back, not loud enough to wake Henry's father, but in a forceful way he'd never seen before. His mother had always walked the fence of conflict between him and his father, striding with one foot firmly planted on each side of the neutral zone that Henry and his father never crossed. Now she was exerting her own will. She loved Henry as a son, he had no doubt, but she had no choice but to honor her husband's wishes. Henry's father was bedridden and could barely speak or move, but he still was head of the home. "I don't want to go. This is his dream, not mine. I was born here. I don't even speak the same dialect as the village he came from. I won't fit in there any more than I fit in at the all-white school he sent me to. Haven't I done enough? Done enough? You have done plenty. You have taken sides with the enemy of China and America. We are allies. They are the enemy. You have become his enemy. And still, he does this for you. For you." "It's not for me," Henry said softly. "And I didn't do this to him." As the words came out, he almost believed them. Almost. But looking at his mother, tears streaming down her face, the anger and frustration so measured she was shaking, he knew he'd always be haunted by this, by the effect his actions had had on his father. Henry looked down at the suit. It was hand-tailored and expensive. The tickets were expensive, too. He had no idea where he'd be going, where he'd be staying, or for how long. And looking at his crying mother, who now spent her days caring for her dying husband, for his dying father, Henry felt his resolve crumble. Maybe 13 wasn't old enough to escape the pain and pressures of his family. Maybe he'd never escape. "When do I leave?" The words fell out of his mouth, rising like a white flag of surrender. He thought about Keiko, feeling farther and farther away from her as each moment passed, as if his heart were already on board the ocean liner and being pulled far away to the sweltering hot South China Sea. "Next week?" his mother whispered. "For how long?" Henry asked. He watched her pause. This was obviously hard on her as well. She was sending him away, fulfilling the wishes of her husband, letting go of her only son. Henry looked up at her, not wanting to go.
3, maybe 4 years.
Silence. Henry mulled it over. Realistically, he had no idea when Keiko would be coming home, if she ever came home. After all, what home did she have to come back to? Maybe the war would go on forever. Maybe she'd be sent to Japan. It was all unknown. But 4 years? It was unthinkable. Henry had never been away from his parents for 4 days.
I can't do that. You must. You have no choice. This is decided.
I will decide. I'm the same age father was when he left, when he made his own choices. If I go, it will be my choice, not his, Henry said. He sensed the conflict in his mother, wanting to obey her husband's wishes, but not wanting to lose her son.
My choice, not his, not yours. What would I tell him? What would you have me say?
Tell him I'll go, but not now. Not until the war is over. Not until she comes back.
I told her I'd wait. I made a promise.
But you won't even see her. For years, maybe.
Then I'll write to her every week.
I cannot tell him, then do as I've done these past years. Say nothing.
She put her head in her hands, rubbing her temples, rocking back and forth.
You are stubborn, just like your father. He made me what I am.
Henry hated saying it, but it was true, wasn't it?
Letters, 1943. Henry wrote to Keiko, telling her about his father's ill-timed intention to send him away. Back to China, a small village where his father grew up, just outside of Canton. Henry still had distant relatives there. People he'd never met. Some not even blood relatives. But they were calabash, as Henry's father put it, using some strange slang of quasi-English. They were together. They were of one mind. Everyone in the village was considered family. And he looked forward to visitors from America. Henry knew from his father's stories that his visit would include a warm homecoming, and a lot of work as well. Part of him wanted to go, but part of him wanted nothing to do with what his father had manipulatively planned for him. And he couldn't go now. Keiko or her family might need him, and they knew so few people outside the camps. He was all they had. Much to Henry's surprise, Keiko thought he should go. Why not? She'd asked in her most recent letter from Camp Minidoka. She was a prisoner. They were apart anyway. Might as well use this time, she'd said, for Henry to complete the schooling so many parents of American-born children wished for their sons. Stubbornly, Henry refused to give in to his father's wishes. His father wanted nothing to do with Keiko, and had disowned him. Henry couldn't set that aside. So he stayed, and continued scholarshipping. He also wrote to Keiko, every week. Henry spent his days at school helping Mrs. Beatty, and his free evenings wandering up and down South Jackson, listening to the brightest jazz musicians the city had to offer. He caught Oscar Holden and Sheldon when he could, but other nights, he just stayed home and wrote to Keiko. In return, she sent Henry notes, with sketches from inside the camp, and even outside, when she was allowed beyond the fences. The stringent rules had been eased a bit after the camp had been completely settled. Keiko's Girl Scout troop was even allowed beyond the barbed wire to have an overnight campout. Amazing, Henry thought. Prisoners being allowed outside, only to return freely. But that was where their families were, and besides, where else could they go? At least she kept busy. Henry did too, walking down to the old post office on South King, near the Yong Kick Noodle Factory. As the months rolled by, his weekly journey had become more of a habit, one still filled with anticipation. "One letter, overland carriage, please," Henry requested, handing over the small envelope with the letter to Keiko he'd written the night before. The skinny girl who normally worked the counter looked to Henry to be about his age, maybe 14, with dark hair and rich olive skin. He assumed she was the daughter of the postmaster assigned to Chinatown, helping out her parents in Chinese fashion.
"Another letter? This one carriage mail, you say? That's going to get expensive. 12 cents this time."
Henry counted out the change from his pocket as she stamped it. He didn't know what else to say. He'd done this routine dozens of times now, long enough to know what was coming next, already seeing the disappointment in the young clerk's eyes.
"I'm sorry, Henry. No mail for you today. Maybe tomorrow?"
It had been 3 weeks now, and no letter from Keiko. He knew that military mail had priority over all domestic shipments, especially letters going to someone with a Japanese surname, not to mention that mail in and out of the prison camps was notoriously slow. But this was troubling, on the verge of heartbreaking. So much that Henry began mailing all his letters by overland carriage, special bus service that cost 10 times the normal postage, but got there quicker. Or so he was always told. Still, no word from Camp Minidoka. No word from Keiko. On the walk home, Henry caught Sheldon wrapping up an afternoon gig on the corner of South Jackson.
"I thought you were playing at the Black Elks Club these days," Henry asked, pausing on the street where he used to give Sheldon his lunch each day.
"Still do? Still do, that's for certain. More sold-out shows than ever. Oscar's packing them in every night. Even more now that there's so many white folks moving their business into these parts."
Henry offered a solemn nod of agreement, looking down toward what was left of Japantown. Most businesses had been sold for pennies on the dollar, or the local banks had seized the frozen businesses and resold the real estate for a profit. Those that were funded by local Japanese-owned banks were the last to fold. But fold they did, as the banks themselves became insolvent, since their owners had been sent to places like Minidoka, Manzanar, and Thule Lake.
"I guess I'd just like to come down and reminisce with my horn once in a while. Think about the good old days, you know?"
Sheldon winked at Henry, who didn't feel like smiling. Those times were gone. Things were different.
"I'm different," Henry thought.
"Looks like you're heading home empty-handed," Sheldon half-asked, half-stated,
as if Henry's sad walk home from the post office would be made any better that way.
"I guess I don't understand. I thought we'd write more. Is it wrong to think that? I know she's busy. Her last letter said she's in school now, playing sports, even on the yearbook staff."
Henry shrugged. "I just didn't think she'd forget about me so quickly."
"Henry, there's no way she's forgotten about you. I guarantee that. Maybe there's just more to do. More to be busy with. What with 10,000 Japanese folks all crammed into one area. Beats what she was used to, up at that white bread, blue blood elementary school y'all used to hang out at."
"At least we were together."
"At most, you were together. And that's a beautiful thing," Sheldon said. "Don't worry. She'll be back someday. Keep the faith. Keep writing. Time and space is a hard one to deal with, let me tell you. Moving all the way up here from the south, I can testify to that one. People relations is hard business. Hard to keep that going. But don't give up. Something good will come of it all. Things have a way of working out just fine. You'll see."
"I wish I was as hopeful as you are," Henry said.
"Hope is all I got. Hope gets you through the night. Now you run along now. Go home and take care of that mama of yours. And you have a fine day, sir."
Henry waved goodbye, wondering if he should try to see her again. Then, he thought of what Keiko's life must be like right now. How wonderful it must be for her, finally to go to school with nothing but Japanese kids, all just like her. A whole community growing in the desert. Maybe there was more for her there than here with me? Maybe she was better off. Maybe.
Good news, Henry.
The young Chinese clerk brushed the hair from her eyes and held out the tattered envelope with both hands.
Looks like she does care after all.
Henry looked up and took the letter, detecting a wisp of a sigh.
Thanks,
was all he could muster. It had been 3 weeks since the last correspondence. He had grown nervous, and sometimes even anticipated a Dear John letter, the kind of dreaded brush-off normally reserved for enlisted men. He held the envelope in his hand, unsure of whether to open it or not, then walked outside and around the corner, finding a bench at the nearest bus stop. Opening it, Henry drew in a deep breath and exhaled slowly as he unfolded the letter. He noticed the date immediately. It was from last week. Seemed like the mail was still occasionally running on time.
Dear Henry.
It wasn't a Dear John letter. Just one of Keiko's normal heartfelt missives, catching Henry up on the crazy day-to-day life in the camp. About how all the men were required to sign loyalty oaths, which would then make them eligible for the draft and military service fighting the Germans. Some, like Keiko's dad, had signed up immediately, so eager to prove their loyalty. Others became resistors, refusing to sign. The worst of them were taken away and imprisoned somewhere else. The note made little mention of Henry's own letters, saying only that she missed him dearly and hoped he was doing okay. Henry wrote her again that night and mailed the letter the next day. This time, he waited months for a reply, and when it came, Keiko seemed more confused and busy than ever. He'd written her 2 more times while waiting and couldn't tell which letter she was responding to, or had a letter been lost. Henry was learning that time apart has a way of creating distance, more than the mountains and time zones separating them. Real distance, the kind that makes you ache and stop wondering. Longing, so bad, that it begins to hurt to care so much. Years, 1945. Henry rounded the corner of South King and ran into Chaz heading home from the post office. Henry had grown a foot since he last saw Chaz, and now realized he wasn't just looking directly into the eyes of his former tormentor. He was actually looking down an inch or two. Chaz looked small and weak, even though he outweighed Henry by 20 or 30 pounds. Face to face, all Chaz could muster was a grudging hello. He didn't even smile. Henry just stared back, doing his best to look cold and intimidating. Chaz, by contrast, looked soft and doughy, cracking first, stepping around Henry and passing him by. "My father's still gonna own your girlfriend, Henry," Chaz muttered as he walked past, just loud enough for Henry to hear.
"What did you say?"
Henry grabbed Chaz by the arm and spun him around, a move that surprised both of them.
"My father's still buying up what's left of Nipville, and when your girlfriend gets back from that concentration camp she's holed up in, she's not going to have anything to come home to."
He shrugged Henry off and backed away, more pathetic and annoying than menacing. "Then what are you going to do?" Stung, Henry let him go, watching him waddle off, up the hill and around the corner out of sight. Henry looked down the street to what was left of Nihomachi. Not much. The only fixtures that remained were the larger buildings, too expensive to buy, like the Panama Hotel, which stood as the sole remaining evidence of a living, breathing community. Little else remained that wasn't completely gutted, torn down, or taken over by Chinese or white business interests. Henry could hardly believe that 2 years had passed. For his father, it had been 2 years of air raids and war updates, from Indochina to Iwo Jima. For Henry, it had been 24 months of writing to Keiko, occasionally getting a reply, maybe every few months. Jess catching up, her concern for him waning. Each time he visited the post office, the same young clerk looked at him with what Henry regarded as a sad combination of pity and admiration.
"She must be very special to you, Henry. You've never given up on her, have you?"
The clerk didn't know much about Henry, just his writing habits and his dedication. And maybe she sensed his pang of emptiness, a hint of loneliness, as Henry left the post office empty-handed each week. Henry thought about taking another bus trip, back in the belly of the big dog, as Sheldon liked to put it, that long Greyhound bus ride through Walla Walla all the way to Minidoka. But he let those thoughts go. He was busy here helping his mother keep up with things, and Keiko seemed okay from the few letters that he received. In her early letters, Keiko had wanted continuous updates on life in Seattle, at school, and in the old neighborhood. Henry had slowly broken it to her that little remained of what she'd once called home. She never seemed to believe that it could disappear like that, in such a short amount of time. She loved this area so much, a place with so many memories. How could it be gone? How could he tell her? When she asked, "What's become of the old neighborhood? Is it still deserted?" he could say only, "It's changed. New businesses have moved in. New people." She seemed to know what that meant. No one seemed to care what happened to what was left of Nihomachi. Chaz had gotten off on his vandalism charges years earlier. The judge wouldn't even hear of it. Henry kept the news to himself, and in the meantime, he'd updated Keiko on the jazz scene on South Jackson, how Oscar Holden was once again holding court at the Black Elks Club, how Sheldon was a regular in the band, and even played a few of his own numbers. Life was moving forward. The United States was winning the war. There was talk of the war in Europe being over by Christmas. The Pacific would be next. Then, just maybe, Keiko would be coming home. Back to what? Henry wasn't sure, but he knew he'd still be here, waiting. At home, Henry spoke politely to his mother, who seemed to regard him as the man of the house now that he was 15 and helping with the bills. He'd taken a part-time job at Min's Barbecue, though he didn't feel particularly helpful, not when other kids his age were lying about their birthdays and enlisting, fighting on the front lines. But it was the least he could do. Despite his mother's best intentions and his father's wishes, Henry remained at home. His schooling in China would wait. It would have to. He had promised to wait for Keiko, and that vow was one he intended to keep, no matter how long it took. His father still had not spoken to him. Then again, since the stroke, he spoke very little to anyone. He'd had another mild one, and his voice was little more than a whisper. Still, Henry's mother turned the radio off and on near his bed when there was a report on the fighting in the Philippines, or Iwo Jima, each battle in the Pacific drawing a breath closer to the expected invasion of Japan itself. A daunting task, since Premier Suzuki had announced that Japan would fight to the very end. When the news was over, she'd read the newspaper to him and report on fundraising activities at the benevolent associations that dotted Chinatown. She told him about how the Kuomintang had expanded their office into an outpost where expressions of nationalist pride could be printed and distributed, along with various fundraising efforts to arm and equip the factions that were fighting back on the mainland. Henry would sit occasionally and have one-way conversations with his father. It was all he could do. His father wouldn't even look at him, but Henry was certain the man couldn't turn his ears away. He had to listen. He was too weak to move on his own power.
So Henry spoke gently, and his father, as always, stared out the window, pretending not to care.
I ran into Chaz Preston today. Do you remember him?
Henry's father sat motionless.
He and his father came by a few years ago. His father was looking for your help in buying some of the vacant buildings, the ones left behind after the Japanese left.
Henry continued, despite his father's lack of response.
He tells me they're buying up the last of Nihomachi, maybe even the Northern Pacific Hotel, maybe even the Panama.
Despite his father's silence and frailty, he was still a highly regarded member of the Bing Kong Benevolent Association and the Chinese Chamber of Commerce. His age and health only made him more revered in certain circles, where honor and respect must be paid to those who had given so much. After he had raised so much money for the war effort, Henry's father's opinion still mattered. Henry had often seen members of the business community come by to get his father's blessing on business arrangements in the neighborhood.
You don't think they'd let Chaz's family, the Prestons, buy the Panama, do you?
Henry had hoped the hotel would remain unsold until Keiko returned, or at least that it might be bought by Chinese interests. But few had the money to make a worthy offer. Henry looked at his father, who turned back, and for the first time in months, intentionally made eye contact with him. It was all he needed to know. Even before his father mustered the energy for a crooked smile, Henry knew. Something was in the works. The Panama Hotel would be sold. Henry didn't know what to make of it. He had waited for Keiko for nearly 3 years. He loved her. He would wait longer if he had to. But at the same time, he wished that when she came home, it would be to more than just him. That part of her old life, part of her childhood, would still be there. That there might be a few of the places she had drawn in her sketchbook. Those memories that meant so much to her. Meeting at the Panama, 1945. After breakfast, Henry helped his mother carry the laundry upstairs, from where she'd hung it to dry in Canton Alley, and then sat next to their old Emerson radio, listening to Texaco Star Theater, a variety show, not the usual news program his father listened to. Henry looked up as his mother wheeled his father into the living room and next to his old reading chair. Behind her ear was a fresh starfire lily that Henry had picked up at the market earlier. "Put it on your father's show," she implored in Cantonese. Henry just turned the radio down, then off completely with a hard click. "I need to talk to him about something. Something important. Do you mind?" Henry asked as politely as possible. His mother just threw up her hands and walked away. He knew she didn't see the use in his having these one-way conversations. Henry's father looked at him for a moment, then cast his frustrated eyes on the radio, as though Henry were a bill collector or a house guest who had long overstayed his welcome. "I'll get to that," Henry said, eyeing the radio. He left it off to make sure his father was listening, undistracted. "I just want to talk about something first." In his hands was the travel script from the China Mutual Steam Navigation Company, his passage to China. Henry let a moment of silence exist between the two of them, a period on the end of the sentence of their whole fractured father-son relationship. "I'll go." As the words punched the air, Henry wasn't sure if his father heard him. He held the travel envelope up for his father to see. "I said, I'll go." Henry's father looked up at his son, waiting. Henry had considered his father's offer to go back to China to finish his schooling. Now that he was older, his time there would only be a year or two. Traveling overseas by steamship and starting life again, far away from everything that reminded him of Keiko, seemed like a reasonable alternative
to moping up and down the crowded streets of South King. Still, part of him hated to give in to his father. His father was so stubborn, so bigoted. Yet the more Henry thought about it, the more he realized maybe there was something good to be had from the whole sad affair.
"I'll go, but only on this condition," Henry said.
Now he really had his father's attention, weak and frail as it was.
"I know the Panama Hotel is for sale. I know who wants to buy it. And since you're an elder member of the downtown associations, I know you have some say in the matter."
Henry took a deep breath.
"If you can prevent the sale, I will do as you wish. I will go and finish my schooling in China. I'll finish the rest of the year here in Seattle, then take the August steamer to Canton."
Henry examined his father's paralyzed expression. The stroke had taken so much of who he was already.
"I'll go."
Henry's father's hand began to tremble in his lap. His cocked head straightened on the frail stem of his weakened neck. His lips quivered as they formed to make sounds, to speak words Henry hadn't heard in years.
"Dodge."
"Thank you." Then he asked,
"Why?"
"Don't thank me," Henry said in Chinese. "I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing it for me, for the girl, the one you hated so much. You got your wish. Now I wish something. I want that hotel left as is, unsold." Henry didn't quite know why. Or did he? The hotel was a living, breathing memory for him, and it was a place his father wanted gone. So having it spared somehow suited him, somehow balanced the scales in his mind. Henry would go to China. He'd start over. And maybe, if that old hotel were still around, Nihomachi could start over too. Not for him. Not for Keiko. But because it needed a place to start from. Sometime in the future. After the war. After the bittersweet memories of him and Keiko were long since paved over. He'd have one reminder left. A placeholder that would be there for him sometime in the future. The next day, Henry mailed his last letter to Keiko. She hadn't written in 6 months. And then, she'd only talked about how much she loved school there, going to sock hops and formal dances. Life for her was full and abundant. She didn't seem to need him. Still, he wanted to see her. In fact, his hopes were high that it might actually happen. And who knew? Maybe he would have a moment with her again. Word was that many families had been released as early as January. And since Minidoka was known as a camp for loyal internees, Keiko might be out right now. If not, she'd be coming home soon. Germany was losing. The war on both fronts would be ending sooner rather than later. Henry hadn't written in several weeks, but this letter was different. This letter wasn't just a goodbye. It was a farewell. He was wishing her a happy life, and letting her know that he'd be leaving for China in a few months, that if she might be returning soon, he'd meet her, one last time, in front of the Panama Hotel. Henry chose a date in March, a month away. If she were coming home soon, she'd get the invitation in time. And if she were still in the camp and needed to write back, there was time for that as well. It was the least he could do. After all, he still loved her. He'd waited over 2 years for her. He could wait one more month, couldn't he? The clerk took the letter and attached the 12-cent overland carriage postage.
"I hope she knows how much you care about her. I hope you tell her."
She held up the envelope and then reverently set it on a pile of outgoing letters.
"I hope she's worth the wait, Henry. I've seen you come and go for all these months. She's a lucky girl, even if she doesn't write back as often as you'd like.
Or ever, Henry thought, smiling to hide his sadness.
This is probably the last time you'll see me, 'cause this is my last letter to that address.
The clerk looked crestfallen, like she'd been following a soap opera that had taken a turn for the worse.
Oh, why? I hear the camps are sending people home left and right. She might be coming home soon. To Seattle, right?
Henry looked out the window at the crowded streets of Chinatown. If people were leaving the camps, few were returning to their original homes, because they weren't there any longer. And besides, no one would rent to them. Stores still refused to sell them goods. The Japanese were no longer welcome in Japantown.
I don't think she's coming back, Henry said,
and turned to the postal clerk and smiled.
And I don't think I can wait any longer. I'm going to Canton to finish my schooling in a few months.
Time to look forward, not back.
Finishing your Chinese schooling?
Henry nodded, but it felt almost like an apology for giving in and for giving up.
Your parents must be so proud then.
Henry cut her off. I'm not doing it for them. Anyway, nice knowing you. He forced a polite smile and turned to the door, looking back, detecting more than a hint of sadness in the young clerk's face. Some things aren't meant to last, Henry thought. 1 month later, just as Henry had said he would, he waited on the steps of the Panama Hotel. From his vantage point, the view had completely changed. Gone were the paper lanterns and the neon signs for the Uji Toko Barber and the Ochi Photography Studio. In their place stood Plymouth Tailors and the Cascade Diner. But the Panama remained as a bulwark against the rising tide of opportunistic development. Henry brushed the pants of his suit and straightened his tie. It was too warm for the jacket, so he kept it in his lap, occasionally brushing the hair that hung across his face to the side as the wind blew it back again. The suit, the one his father had bought and his mother had tailored, fit him well. He'd finally grown into it. Soon, he'd be wearing it on his voyage to China, to live with relatives and attend a new school, a place where he'd be special all over again. Sitting there, watching handsome couples stroll by arm in arm, Henry allowed himself to miss Keiko. He'd pushed those feelings aside months ago, when her letters stopped, knowing that time and space don't always make the heart remember, sometimes just the opposite. At the thought of Keiko not coming back, or the more dreaded yet all too real alternative, that she'd forgotten or moved on, Henry grew less worried and simply began to despair. After school, sometimes alone, sometimes with Sheldon, he'd walk down Maynard Avenue, looking at what was left of the once vibrant Nihomachi. The time he'd spent there, walking Keiko home, sitting and watching her paint or draw in her sketchbook. It all seemed like a lifetime ago. Someone else's lifetime.
He didn't really think she'd show up, but he had to try, to make one last noble gesture, so when he boarded that ship, he could leave knowing he'd given it his all. One last hope. Hope was all he had, and like Mr. Okabe had said as he and his family had left on that train, almost 3 years earlier, hope can get you through anything.
In his suit pocket was his father's silver pocket watch. Henry drew it out and opened it, listening to the sweeping, ticking sound to make sure it was working. It was. It was almost noon, the time he'd said he'd be here, waiting. He looked at his reflection in the polished crystal of the pocket watch. He looked older. More grown up. He looked like his father when his father had been in his prime, and it surprised him.
The seconds ticked by, and in the distance, he could hear the noon whistle blow at Boeing Field, and then an echo on the wind as Todd Shipyard signaled their lunchtime hour. Time had come and gone. He was done waiting. Then he heard footsteps, the unmistakable clip-clop of a woman's heels against the pavement. A long, slender shadow bled across the steps and blanketed his reflection in the watch, revealing the second hand and the hour hand, straight up, 12 o'clock. She was standing there, a young woman, in fine black leather heels, bare legs, a long blue pleated skirt that rocked back and forth from her hips in the cool springtime air. Henry couldn't bear to look up. He'd waited so long. He held his breath and closed his eyes, listening. Listening to the sounds on the busy street, the cars cruising by, the chatter of the street vendors, the wailing of a saxophone on some nearby street corner. He could smell her jasmine perfume. He opened his eyes, looking up to see a short-sleeved blouse, white, with tiny blue speckles and pearl buttons. Looking into her face, he saw her. For a brief moment, he saw Keiko's face. Older, her long black hair parted to one side, wearing a touch of makeup, just enough to define her supple cheeks, something he'd never seen before. She stepped to the side, and Henry blinked, staring into the sun for a moment before she blocked out the glare and he could see her again. It wasn't Keiko. He could see her clearly. She was young and beautiful. But she was Chinese, not Japanese. And she held a letter in her hands, offering it to him.
I'm so sorry, Henry.
It was the clerk, the young woman from the post office, the one Henry had said hello to for over 2 years, coming and going, mailing letters to Minidoka. Henry had never seen her dressed up before. She looked so different.
This came back, unopened, last week. It's marked return to sender. I'm afraid she's no longer there, or...
Henry took the letter and studied the ugly black return stamp, which had stepped on the address he'd so lovingly written in his best penmanship. The ink had bled across the face of the envelope, streaking like tears. When he turned it over, he noticed the letter had been opened.
I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't have. But I just felt so bad. And then I hated the thought of you sitting here, waiting for someone who was never going to come.
Henry felt numb with disappointment, and a little confused.
So you came to bring me this?
He settled into the sidewalk and looked into her eyes, seeing them in a way he'd never seen them before, noticing how pained she looked.
Actually, I came to bring you this.
She handed Henry a bundle of starfire lilies, tied with a piece of blue ribbon.
I see you buying them in the market once in a while. I guess I figured they were your favorite, and maybe someone should give you some for a change.
Stunned, Henry took the flowers, looking at each one, inhaling the sweet fragrance, feeling the weight of them in his hands. He couldn't help but notice her earnest, hopeful, fragile smile.
Thank you.
Henry was touched. His disappointment melted away.
I don't even know your name.
Her smile brightened.
I'm Ethel. Ethel Chen.
VJ Day, 1945. 5 months. That was how long Henry had been dating Ethel. She was a sophomore at Garfield High School and lived up the hill on 8th Avenue with her family, of whom Henry's parents immediately approved. In many ways, Henry felt like Ethel was a second chance. He'd hoped, even prayed, for Keiko to come back, or at least to write and explain where she'd gone and why. Not knowing hurt almost as much as losing her, because he never really knew what had happened. Life got complicated, he supposed. Yet in some strange, loving way, he hoped she was happy, wherever she was, and with whoever she might be with. Henry, on the other hand, was with Ethel now, and Sheldon from time to time, of course, as always. Still, Henry could never forget about Keiko. In fact, each morning he'd wake up, think of her, and ache for what he'd lost. Then he would remind himself of Ethel, and imagine a time, years from now, when he might actually forget about Keiko, for a day, a week, a month, maybe longer. On a park bench at the corner of South King and Maynard, he and Sheldon sat and soaked up the warm August afternoon. His friend didn't play the streets much anymore. His regular gig at the Black Elks Club paid the bills, and the streets just weren't the same, Sheldon complained. He'd even headed north along the waterfront, looking for new corners to play, new tourists to play for. But his heart wasn't in it. The club was where he belonged now.
"I'm gonna miss seeing you around these parts, Henry," Sheldon said, cracking a roasted peanut, tossing the shells into the street, offering the bag to his friend. Henry took a handful.
"I'll be back. This is home. Right here. I'm going to China to learn all I can, see some long-lost relatives. But that's not who I am. This place is who I am. This is home for me. Still, it's hard to believe that in one more week, I'll set sail for southern China, and a village filled with relatives I've never seen, with names I couldn't even pronounce."
"You do sense the irony now, don't you?" Sheldon asked, spitting a piece of peanut shell out the side of his mouth.
"That I waited for her? For Keiko? And now I'm asking Ethel to wait for me? I know. It doesn't exactly make sense. But she said she'd wait. And I believe her. She will. My parents love her. And as much as I hate to see my father so happy under the circumstances, he is. But he did his part. I told him I'd go, if he'd do me a favor in return. And he kept his word. He wants to talk all the time now, but I just don't know."
"About your old man?"
"We lived under the same roof, but didn't speak for 2, almost 3 years. At least he didn't speak to me, didn't acknowledge my presence. And now he wants his proud son back. I don't know how to feel. So I just let Ethel talk to him. And that seems to work." Sheldon cracked open another peanut, shaking his head, sucking the salt off the shell before tossing it.
"Speaking of?"
Henry looked up to see Ethel running across the street, crossing into traffic. They had begun dating the day Henry waited at the Panama Hotel. She'd bought him lunch, and he'd bought her dinner. Although they went to different schools, they saw each other as much as they could. They spent all day together on Saturdays, walking arm in arm along the waterfront, or catching the No. 6 bus to Woodland Park, splashing in the wading pools, and chasing each other through the zoological gardens. They even shared their first kiss atop the Smith Tower, 35 stories up, watching the sunset over the city, lighting the harbor, shadowy mountains in the distance. Henry kept the admission ticket, a worn stub for 50 cents that reminded him of that perfect evening, in his wallet. One place Henry never took Ethel, though, was the Black Elks Club. He never even mentioned the smoking joint where Oscar Holden held court and Sheldon played backup. That memory was special to Henry, something he couldn't easily share. Sheldon never asked about it. He seemed to understand without needing an explanation. As Henry stood up, she threw her arms around him, squeezing him, shaking him, looking frantic and ecstatic at the same time.
"Hey, hey, what's the hurry? Did I miss something? What's the matter, are you okay?"
Henry said, as she tried to get the words out. was all she could muster, holding Henry's hand. She was almost hysterical, blissful in her abandon.
"Listen, listen. Can you hear it?"
She reached out and took Sheldon's hand as well. Henry looked down the street in stunned amazement. All the cars on South King had stopped, frozen, some right in the middle of the intersection with 7th Avenue. People were running into the streets, pouring out of shops and office buildings. In the distance, everywhere, Henry heard bells ringing, then cars honking. The commuter ferries that sat in their terminal moorings sounded their foghorns. The sounds roared from open windows and storefronts. Not the wailing siren of an air raid drill, not that piercing, menacing horn blaring from the rooftops, but cheering that roared like a wave, crashing into all parts of Chinatown, the International District, and the whole city of Seattle. The news spread from person to person, house to house, block to block. The Japanese had surrendered. Everywhere Henry looked, people flooded into the streets, dancing on the hoods of parked cars. Grown men were screaming like little boys. Grown women, even stoic Chinese women, openly crying tears of joy. Sheldon broke out his horn, slipped in the reeded mouthpiece, and began to wail, strutting around in the middle of South King between a milk truck and a police car, whose sirens flashed in slow, lazy circles. Ethel wrapped her arms around Henry. He looked down and kissed her. Everyone else was doing it. Even total strangers embraced and cried. Others brought out glasses of wine, glasses of anything. Deep down, Henry had known the war's end was imminent. Everyone knew. Everyone felt it. He'd wondered what he would feel. Joy? Relief? He'd wondered what his father would do to occupy his time, now that the Japanese had surrendered. Then again, he knew the war would go on in his father's mind. This time, it would be the Kuomintang, the nationalists versus the communists. China's struggle would continue, and so would his father's. Despite the years of scholarshiping at Rainier, and the hordes of Chinese kids who had shouted "White Devil" as he walked to school each morning, Henry had never felt more American than right then, celebrating the greatest victory in the history of history. It was a joy that was simple, unexpected, and carried with it a quiet peace. It was a happy ending that brought the promise of a new beginning. So when Ethel finally let go, her lips still wet and soft from Henry's kiss, the words came out like a secret confession. And somehow, it made sense. Somehow it fit. If Henry had had doubts before, they were obfuscated by the ringing church bells and yelling, crying crowds. "Ethel?" She straightened her hair and pulled the seams of her dress, trying to look composed in the frenzy of the moment. "Will you marry me?" No sooner had Henry said it than alarms went off in his head. The realization that words aren't toys to be played with, and hearts were at stake. He didn't regret asking. He was just a little surprised that he had. After all, they were young, but no younger than many of the picture brides who had come over from Japan. Besides, he was leaving in a week for China. He'd be gone 2 years at least, and she had said she'd wait. Now, she'd have something worth waiting for.
"Henry? I could have sworn you just asked me to marry you."
Jazz musicians began pouring into the streets from the clubs on South Jackson, some cheering, others riffing spontaneously.
"I did. I'm asking you now. Will you marry me?"
She didn't say a thing. The tears in her eyes from the happiest day in the history of Seattle flowed again for a whole new reason.
"Is that a yes or no?"
Henry asked, suddenly feeling naked and vulnerable. Ethel, on the other hand, looked inspired. Henry watched her climb on the hood of a police car, even before the officer could get out to stop her. She turned to the crowd in the street and yelled,
"I'm getting married!"
The crowd roared its approval, and men and women tilted their glasses back and toasted her. As the officer helped her down, she found Henry's eyes and nodded.
Yes, she said. Yes, I'll wait. And yes, I'll marry you. So hurry back. I might not wait forever.
It was during that moment, that exchange, when all fell silent in Henry's mind. The crowds and the horns and the sirens lowered their volumes. And he noticed for the first time a few Japanese families in the crowd, trying their best to go about their business unnoticed, saddled with the poor luck of somehow being related to the losing team, or coming from the wrong side of town due to unfortunate circumstances beyond their control. Some Japanese families, scores in fact, had trickled back in the previous months, but they found little left of their belongings, and even less in the way of opportunity to start again. Even with the assistance of the American Friends Service Committee, a group that offered to help Japanese families find homes and rent apartments, few stayed. It was during this stolen moment, this spot of quiet melancholy, that Henry saw what he most wanted and most feared. Standing across the street, staring directly at him, were a pair of beautiful chestnut-brown eyes. What did he see in them? He couldn't tell. Sadness and joy? Or was he projecting what was in his own heart? She stood motionless, taller now, her hair much longer, as it drifted away from her shoulders in the direction of the cool summer breeze. Henry rubbed his eyes, and she was gone, lost in the celebrating crowds that still flooded the streets. But it couldn't have been Keiko. She'd have written. Walking home, along the littered, ticker-tape-covered sidewalk, Henry wondered how his father was taking the news. He knew his mother would probably prepare a feast. Something to celebrate was so rare during times of rationing. But his father, who knew? Inside, in Henry's quiet thoughts, he couldn't escape the memory of Keiko. The what-ifs. What if he had said something differently? What if he'd asked her to stay? But he couldn't forget the love, the sincere feelings Ethel had as she delighted in her engagement, holding Henry close, giving all of her heart so unselfishly. Around the corner, Henry looked up at the window of his Canton Alley apartment. He'd be leaving it next week for China. As he was thinking of how his mother would hold up during his farewell, he heard her shouting his name. Yelling, in fact. Not the vocal celebration of the others on the street. This was something else.
Henry? It's your father.
Henry saw her waving frantically through the open window, the same one she hated for him to leave open. He ran, up the street and up the steps to his apartment. Ethel tried to keep up, then shouted at him to go on. She knew, even before Henry knew. She'd spent far more time with Henry's father than anyone but his mother. In the apartment he shared with his parents, Henry saw Dr. Luke once again, closing his black bag, looking broken and defeated.
"I'm sorry, Henry." "What's happening?"
Henry burst into his parents' room. His father was in bed, looking pale. His feet curled in at impossible angles, rigid and lifeless from the knees down. His breathing rattled in his chest. The only other noise was that of Henry's mother crying. He put his arms around her, and she held him close, patting the side of his face.
"He doesn't have long, Henry,"
the doctor explained sadly.
"He wanted to see you. One last time. He's been holding on for you."
Ethel arrived in the doorway, out of breath, and looking pained as she saw the condition of her future father-in-law. She patted the arm of Henry's mother, who began to have that vacant look of quiet acceptance. Henry sat next to the frail shell that was left of his once domineering father.
"I'm here," he said in Chinese. "You can go now. Your ancestors are waiting. You don't need to wait for me anymore. The Japanese surrendered. I'm going to China next week. And I'm marrying Ethel.
if the words were a surprise to anyone,